No show again tonight for the John Stewart of Egypt. Today, Friday, November 8th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Satirist Bassem Youssef is still off the air in Egypt. He may have struck an unfunny nerve with Egypt's current military ruler, General al-Sisi.
Eating cupcakes with Sisi's face on them, and whether he was patriotic enough, should he buy a half pound of chocolates with the chairman of the armed forces or a quarter pound?
Also today, staging the story of a family torn apart by immigration woes.
I've never met my little sister, so it would be, you know, life-changing for me to be able to meet my little sister and see my mom again.
Plus, a film critic remembers the first time she saw the work of legendary anime director Hayao Miyazaki.
I remember just thinking, I am seeing something so new, so original, and so darn beautiful.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One of the most powerful storms ever recorded. Just let that sink in for a second. Yeah, it was one of the biggest storms ever that slammed into the central Philippines today. Super Typhoon Haiyan caused massive havoc, ripping the roofs off houses, toppling power lines, and cutting communications. It also killed a number of people and forced hundreds of thousands to evacuate from its path. Earlier, we reached British tourist Mark Dashwood. He's on the Philippine island of Boracay and wasn't able to leave the island before the storm hit. So he had to take shelter in a hotel.
At its worst, it was incredibly windy outside. We were getting reports of winds up to 300 kilometers an hour. The trees were, almost toppled over. Some of the roofs on the buildings next door were beginning to peel away, and there was a lot of debris flying around.
Could you hear it where you were? It must have been incredibly loud.
It was. It was a kind of a howling noise, and then occasionally it would go quiet, and then you would get another kind of swoosh of wind again. And then there was a moment where it went very calm, which it must have been the eye of the storm.
So now that things have calmed down a little bit, have you been outside and taken a walk around?
We've literally just walked down to the hotel reception now, so we had to walk outside, and it's really calm. There's a lot of devastation, but from what I can see, there's a lot of trees on the ground and lots of debris on the floor.
Tell me what you were doing in Boracay in the first place.
I'm taking a bit of time out of work and decided to go on a backpacking trip around Asia. So I came to Boracay about 4 days ago. I flew from South Korea straight into Manila and then straight down to Boracay. And then it was 2 days ago that we first started to hear about the storm coming in. So the first thing I did was book a flight to Manila, but unfortunately we weren't able to get off the island because they closed the port.
What have you heard in terms of, basic supplies, food, clean water, medical supplies? Is that a challenge right now?
We've been watching the news constantly. We hear reports of lots of food supplies being sent to various evacuation centers. I think there's one just off the road from the hotel. I think I'll have more of an idea tomorrow. It's really hard to tell at the moment what the extent of the devastation is.
And Mark, you're a doctor. Has anybody asked you for medical assistance?
No, it hasn't got to that stage here. I'm quite interested to see what it's like tomorrow. I know there's a hospital up the road, so my plan is to go there and see if there's anything that we can do. At the moment, we don't want to really leave the hotel.
Right. I mean, being unable to leave the hotel up until now through this typhoon, I'm just wondering how communications is going and whether there's a sense of panic or it's been pretty calm so far.
Now everyone's calm and there's a real sense of relief. The most kind of harrowing part of this whole experience was actually yesterday when I was trying to escape. Hundreds of people were trying to do the same thing, and we're all queuing to get the last few boats that they supplied. People were pushing and screaming, and that was the worst part of all of this.
Did it feel like this could be one of the worst in history? I know you're not a regular in the Philippines, but...
Well, funny enough, this is the second typhoon that I've experienced. I was actually stuck in New York almost a year ago to the day during Hurricane Sandy. So typhoons. I seem to have a bit of bad luck when it comes to typhoons. But, I mean, this felt a lot worse than Sandy, actually.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for your time and for speaking with us. Greatly appreciate it.
No problem.
British tourist Mark Dashwood speaking with us earlier. He's on the Philippine island of Boracay, which took a hit from Super Typhoon Haiyan today. As for visual evidence of the destruction wrought by Haiyan, we have a slideshow at PRI.org. In Egypt, Friday means many things. It's a Muslim holy day, for one. But for many Egyptians, Friday is also the day when they settle down in front of their TVs to watch El Bernameg, or The Program. That's a Jon Stewart-esque fake news show hosted by Egyptian funny man Bassem Youssef. Well, the show was yanked last Friday, and it's still off the air. Jonathan Geyer follows Egyptian satire closely. He publishes Cartoon, a blog about Arabic political comics. Jonathan, one week on, what do we know about why Bassem Youssef's show was canceled?
Well, in the first episode of this season, Bassem Youssef delicately criticized the military, specifically the cult surrounding the chairman of the armed forces, Sisi. And this went to very deep questions about the foundation of the ouster of President Morsi. Was it a coup or an uprising? Was one of the questions that Bassem asked on his program that very few are willing to debate right now in this polarized environment of Cairo. He also was eating cupcakes with Sisi's face on them and making jokes about whether he was patriotic enough. Should he buy a half pound of chocolates with the chairman of the armed forces or a quarter pound? He was really taking aim at this whole new military movement that's really taken hold in the populace since the ouster of Morsi.
Now, Bassem Youssef had been on a break, a three-month break, before recording that first episode back on the air. So that actually was broadcast. Why was the second episode canceled? And presumably he's off the air until further notice, right?
No one's sure, Marco. There's great speculation that it has more to do with the TV network, the privately owned CBC, and a contractual agreement. There's speculation that Bassem made fun of the duplicity of the channel, made fun of their TV hosts and the way they cover the news, but we really can't be sure, and we haven't really heard from Bassem since that episode was recorded but never aired.
What has the network said about the show being canceled?
After the initial first episode, where he did take aim at the military ever so slightly, the network distanced themselves from Bassem Youssef. And in the second episode, as I said, they really made it seem like it was a contractual issue. But I have to say it has to do with politics, because Bassem has really been a polarizing voice. There were demonstrations outside of the recording of that episode, which never aired. Dozens of riot police, ostensibly to protect Bassem, should these protesters have attacked him. Then, on the other hand, there are liberals who say that Bassem hasn't gone far enough. He didn't criticize the violence of the regime on August 14th, which killed hundreds of protesters, and he really only alluded to some of the overreaching that the military has done.
This is a private network that broadcasts Bassem Youssef. Are they in a bind with a charismatic host like Bassem Youssef, who wants to make fun of everything, including the military?
Well, Bassem has a huge following. You know, he started on YouTube in 2011 and quickly went viral. He's one of the most prominent comics in the Arab world right now. He writes a weekly column for a major newspaper here. And last week, he criticized liberals for a lurch to the right and kind of chastised them for not supporting him in the face of this ostensible military censorship.
Is Bassem Youssef still writing that column, or is that out as well?
Oh, he's still writing the column. And he's written a lot about how anti-Semitism is sort of as ridiculous as Islamophobia in the West.
So, Jonathan, you follow a lot of cartoons. And how has the cancellation of Bassem Youssef's show shown up in political satire?
Well, cartoonists are basically outraged. One really funny cartoon today had these two school children walking. And one of them says, "I'm very, very anxious." And the other goes, "The Constitution?" And the first child goes, "No, Bassem Youssef." So he's really struck a chord with that first episode, and people were really waiting for him to criticize the military for them, because there has been this great nationalistic fervor that's constricted the space for political expression here.
So Jon Stewart appeared on Bassem Youssef's show last year. I think Bassem Youssef's appeared on The Daily Show. Has Jon Stewart said anything since Youssef's show was canceled? Do you know if they're even in touch?
I can't speak to that, but I would like to say that Bassem Youssef is much more than Egypt's Jon Stewart. For one, he has to deal with these ambiguous red lines, these sort of what is acceptable to say and joke about. Can you joke about mass violence? Can you joke about the president? And beyond that, he's really Egyptian in his humor. He uses a lot of cabaret and song and dance. There's whole musical numbers with up to 50 folks singing about, you know, Morrissey's ouster and to the tune of Old MacDonald Had a Farm. So it's really a unique way of approaching political crisis, and certainly he's at a greater risk than Jon Stewart.
Satire junkie Jonathan Geyer speaking with us from Cairo. He publishes Cartoon, a blog about Arabic political comics, and he's also senior editor of the Cairo Review of Global Affairs. Jonathan, thank you.
Thanks very much, Marco.
Fans of Japanese animation, or anime, are going into withdrawal. That's because legendary anime director Hayao Miyazaki is retiring. His final feature, The Wind Rises, opens today for 1 week only in L.A. and New York. Just enough time to get in the Oscar chase. Miyazaki's made a career out of producing otherworldly films. But as the world's Bradley Campbell reports, this one is grounded on Earth.
The trailer for Hayao Miyazaki's last film starts with a poem. Who has seen the wind? Neither I nor you. But when the leaves hang trembling, the wind is passing through. Let the wind carry these wings to you. That's our entry point to Miyazaki's fictionalized story of the Japanese aeronautical engineer Jiro Horikoshi. He's the man who created the Mitsubishi A6M0. It was a military plane built in the 1940s. The thing was lightweight, maneuverable, and it could fly, it seemed, forever.
The problem, though, with this plane in particular, is that it's an amazing aircraft, but it was used to do horrible things.
That's Brian Ashcraft of Osaka, Japan. He's a writer for the website Kotaku, and he says this plane became notorious for bombing Pearl Harbor and for shooting Allied planes out of the sky. Despite the movie's focus on the Zero, it really isn't about war, though. It's about a man pursuing his dream, creating the perfect airplane. That's ironic for a man who spent his life creating fantastic worlds of beauty. The Wind Rises opened in Japan last summer. It's already raked in tens of millions. But that said, not everyone has taken to it. Ashcraft has been writing about the reaction to the film, and he says it stirred plenty of online controversy.
I think just kind of the imagery and then what this plane came to represent, that it might be a bridge too far for some.
In Japan, some people called Miyazaki a traitor and anti-Japanese. In South Korea, some criticized the film as glorifying Japanese imperialism. Some of the conflicting complaints might be due to Miyazaki's storytelling style. Idiosyncratic is a word that critics often use to describe his work and that of his production house, Studio Ghibli. And yet,
in Japan, Studio Ghibli movies are what kids grow up on. So when kids are really small, this is what they watch. And it's become really entrenched in the culture.
Miyazaki also has his fans abroad. People like Susan Napier, a professor of Japanese studies at Tufts University. She's writing a book about Miyazaki. And her first Miyazaki moment of sorts was watching one of his early films, Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind.
I remember just thinking, I'm seeing something so new, so original, so imaginative, and so darned beautiful.
Napier says she cried at the end of his newest movie, partly because she knows it's his last.
Personally, as a fan and as someone who really has been touched and moved by so many of his works, it's a huge loss because he's absolutely unique. There is no one like him.
And that's why Brian Ashcraft finds it so interesting to see Miyazaki tackle such loaded subject matter in his final bow.
It's fascinating to see a director who's in his early 70s still have something to say and not just kind of go out quietly.
Although if he does find retirement a bore, well, there are plenty of fans who would welcome his return. For The World, I'm Bradley Campbell.
Still ahead on The World, Rob Ford's reputation precedes, well, all the other Rob Fords on the planet on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Life in the aftermath of a natural disaster is never easy for survivors. War certainly makes it worse. That's the case in Pakistan's southwestern province of Balochistan. A big earthquake there more than a month ago killed 400 people and left hundreds of thousands needing aid. Now the Pakistani government and Baloch separatist rebels are fighting over who should deliver the aid. Marvish Ahmed reports from Mashki Gajar, one of the worst-hit areas. She was there on the day that the Pakistan army wrested control of the rebels' main medical camp.
Hidden under the rickety top of a makeshift hut, we're not sure if we should stick our heads out to see what's happening or continue to live under the illusion that we're safe as long as we can't see the sky. I'm sitting with four Baloch women, one girl, and a little boy. All of us are in the dark on a bright Monday morning. There's no reception on our phones, and we have no idea where anyone is. Some of the men left on motorcycles in the morning, escaping into the mountains. And my hosts are worried for their families and of what would happen now. I arrived in Mashki Gajar with the Pakistani relief group ED Foundation. They've been ferrying patients between the earthquake-hit areas and hospitals in the nearest major city, Karachi. After the quake hit this part of Pakistan at the end of September, ED helped bury 183 bodies from Mashki Gajar alone. Weeks on, the villages still lie in ruins with little relief in sight. Much-needed aid has been delayed because of a war the state refuses to acknowledge between the Pakistan army that moved in and the Balochistan Liberation Front, or the BLF, that was already here. They're fighting over who gets to provide relief and medical supplies. Essen Kamal, a political science lecturer at Qaid-e-Azam University in Islamabad, says the earthquake-hit areas have become a battleground for a much bigger issue. Essentially, who will win over the people in this forgotten corner of the country?
In Balochistan right now, you have the military at one hand trying to control who delivers aid and which agencies can operate in that region, whereas on the other sides, the separatist groups, they are also wanting to control the aid, deliver it themselves. And so there's this kind of conflict on who gets to deliver aid.
The provincial government in Balochistan has called on neutral international relief organizations to step in. The general secretary of the local separatist political party, Abdul Manan, agrees. Baloch, for and against the Pakistani state, say the solution is simple. The UN, Red Cross, and others need to enter and help. According to Manan, however, the Pakistani state won't let that happen.
Pakistan is not allowing the MSF, Pakistan is not allowing the United Nations, and also Pakistan not allowing the NGOs from Pakistan. They are not allowing them.
The army is seen by many here as the enemy, a perpetrator of human rights violations in the name of stamping out the Baloch rebellion. Kidnapping and torture have been well documented by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Professor Essen Kamal says the state is using the earthquake as an excuse to take control of the area. Security forces say they're only in the region to distribute relief. Major General Muhammad Samrid Salik says more than 2,800 tons of food and 34,000 tents have been distributed in the hardest hit areas, including Mashki Gajar, and dismisses the need for any help from foreign relief groups. He admits there are problems delivering aid, but blames that on the rebel groups.
We are in all locations. So far, the miscreants have tried to hinder our activities. They have also tried to coerce the locals not to accept these supplies. They have, in certain cases, they have also tried to burn the supplies that were given to the locals.
But for 10-year-old Maria, who lives in a tent in Mashki Gajar, the major's explanation doesn't fit with her reality. They have hurt us, she says. They kill our people, they throw shells on our heads, they scare us children. We do not want army relief, we want them to go away. A harsh winter is not far off in Balochistan, and thousands continue to remain homeless. My hosts in Mashki Gajar tell me that most people have left to find shelter with friends and family. Those who remain behind have no idea when or if their houses will be rebuilt. For The World, I'm Mavish Ahmed in Islamabad.
Okay, a little something different now for all you fans out there of our GeoQuiz. We want to try something new, and we need your help and your curiosity. So send us your travel stories or geographic curiosity questions. Take us somewhere in the form of a quiz. We'll pick some of your best quizzes to share here on the show. Ready? Here's the first one.
Hi, my name is Ben Leeds Carson. I'm a composer living in Santa Cruz, California. That was my cat, Moira, who is going to be 17 years old in December. So I'm a frequent listener to The World, and I love the Geo Quiz. And while I was listening recently, I remembered a quiz my father used to give us. Of the following U.S. states, Connecticut, Nebraska, and California, which ones fall entirely south of Canada's southernmost border? So again, the question is, Connecticut, Nebraska, and California, which ones fall entirely south of Canada's southernmost border? And the answer is none. The U.S. border with Canada at its southernmost point in Lake Erie dips just below the 42nd parallel, which means it's just below the northern borders of Connecticut, Utah, Nebraska, and California. Canada's middle island is actually more than a quarter of a degree south of the 42nd parallel, which places it further south than locations in 27 of the 50 United States. When I was young, my father, who is still a geologist at Whitman College, his research took us all across the United States several times, and we crossed both the United States and Canada by car nearly a dozen times. When my father was in the driver's seat, he paid almost as much attention to the landscape as he did to where we were going, and so there were often clever little quizzes that would come out about the Missoula floods, or about glaciation, or about the plate tectonics of our continent. It was almost like we were getting a geology lecture every day in the car. One of the things that a geologist knows about the landscape is that there are so many layers of time that are evident all in one place and all in one view. And for me, knowing that time exists kind of all at once in one place has a really big impact on my work as a composer. And it encourages me to think of music as something that can be fast and slow at the same time. It encourages me to think of rhythms as occurring in many different directions and places all at once.
Great stuff, Ben. Music composed by world listener Ben Leeds Carson in Santa Cruz, California. Learn how you can submit your own quiz. Just text GeoQuiz, one word, to 69866. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a play that celebrates the Mexican immigrant success story.
The story of the good girls, the story of the hardworking families, the story of not the gangs and the barrio and all of that, but the story of millions and millions of people who are in this country just working and trying to get through every day.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. I don't know about you, but I'm glad I'm not Rob Ford this week. The Toronto mayor has been generating horrible headlines for smoking crack cocaine and other disturbing behaviors, all caught on videotape. But spare a thought for Rob Ford, lecturer at the University of Manchester in England. He didn't do anything wrong. Yet he and other Rob Fords out there are suffering the cyber consequences, especially on Twitter.
Somebody called me the Chris Farley of Canada, referencing that guy from Saturday Night Live who probably weighed about 300 pounds, I think. So I had to reply to him and say, no, actually, thankfully, I don't quite look like that. I've had various other ones to do with, you know, you should resign, or, you know, Some people sort of seem to be in favor of Rob Ford's lifestyle choices as well. So you get a few people saying, you know, keep it up and all this kind of thing. So, but mostly the Twitter sentiment seems to be pretty negative.
I mean, how do you kind of deal with that and how do you respond to people on Twitter? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's kind of a sad story, the one about Rob Ford, the Toronto mayor.
I do feel a bit sorry for him, not just because he shares my name, because he's not really the kind of guy who's cut out for that kind of high-pressure job. The way I respond to these guys is I just kind of point out the error, and generally I try and make a joke about it. And 95% of the time, what I get extremely sort of polite and apologetic responses. The Canadians certainly sort of live up to their reputation for being a very civil bunch.
And then, how so?
Well, they always are sort of really, really sorry about making the mistake and really sorry for you that you unfortunately share this name. And some of them say, oh, you should come over to Toronto. You should come and run as our mayor. You'd be much better and all this kind of thing. So it's kind of boosted my opinion of Canadians generally, I think.
Your name is actually trending now on Twitter. Congratulations. Hashtag Rob Ford. Does that feel strange or good or bad? What does it feel like?
It is a little bit sort of surreal. All of my friends get hold of this stuff, and so they have endless fun with it. But it is quite a common name. So I did have this experience before when my name was all over billboards because there was that film, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Mm. So I've kind of been here before a little bit. It's just the hazards of having a very common name, I guess.
How many Rob Fords have you run across in your lifetime?
As a matter of fact, my father had a big book of Fords, as he called it, that someone whose surname is Ford actually compiles an enormous sort of global compendium of all the Fords that are sort of out there. And that was about 3 or 4 inches thick, so it's clearly a lot of us.
The BBF, the Big Book of Fords.
That's right, yeah, it's still up on the shelf somewhere.
We actually spoke with a couple of Rob Fords today, and one Rob Ford, who's a broadcaster for the Houston Astros, said he was almost relieved that Rob Ford's crime seemed kind of ridiculous. He mentioned another sports broadcaster that was named Jerry Sandusky, who was also a college football coach serving time for child sex abuse. Two different people. So I'm just wondering, is there any relief that, wow, this could have been so much worse?
That's very true. I mean, this is the kind of situation where you can really kind of laugh it off. The whole story's kind of lurid, but in a kind of sort of semi-ridiculous way, whereas if something much more grave like that, then the name mix-up becomes a much more sort of an anxiety-producing phenomenon. The relief that it's the kind of story that people can laugh about.
I'm just curious, what kind of impression do you now have of Toronto, the city with this Rob Ford business as its most current calling card?
The impression I get based on the Torontons I've been dealing with is they seem to be a very nice bunch. I've always been keen to visit because a colleague of mine actually worked out there for a year and raves about it as being a really great place to go. So I was keen on it even before. I am kind of mystified how they ended up electing this guy. And, you know, I am actually a politics lecturer, so maybe I should look into that and maybe do a bit of research about what explains the popularity of my namesake. It seems like his eccentricity should have been known like fairly early on. But, you know, we have the odd eccentric mayor down here as well. The London one's quite well known, so I guess it does happen.
Rob Ford? Nope, not that Rob Ford. This Rob Ford lectures on politics at the University of Manchester in England. Rob, thanks a lot for your time.
Hey, no problem. Cheers.
As we all know now, Toronto's mayor isn't the only one under surveillance. We all are, in a way, as all those classified NSA documents leaked by Edward Snowden keep reminding us. That's got many Americans worried about their privacy, or the lack of it, but in some other parts of the globe, it's different, like in the Middle East. Daniel Estrin has our story.
Privacy in Israel? There isn't much of it, especially when it comes to matters of security.
I know the situation in Israel, and I know that it can happen.
Hilam Mann is a 20-year-old soldier.
If Israel is listening to people now, who in Israel, who might they be listening to? Who do you think they are spying on?
Like Israeli friends of Palestinians. Because if they need to find out something about Palestinians that get into Israel or trying to do something, so they will listen to Israeli citizens who are in touch with these people. I think that's horrible, but like, it's for the security of Israel. Everything is here is for the security of Israel.
But what is being done? How much domestic wiretapping takes place in Israel? No one really knows.
There really is very little information available to the public on security wiretapping.
Laila Margalit, an attorney with the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, submitted a Freedom of Information request to the Prime Minister's office last year to get just a broad idea of what the government is doing. A few months ago, her request was denied.
Israeli society is a society which has a lot of experience with terrorism and with war, and which tends to place a lot of faith in its security agencies, is generally very willing to make compromises for security.
What is clear is that the law allows the Shin Bet, Israel's FBI, to collect any data from Israeli phone companies and internet providers. No judicial warrant is needed. But unlike in the U.S., domestic surveillance has not become a topic of debate here. This is actually the first time attorney Laila Margalit has even been asked to give an interview on the subject.
People generally assume that that they're not the target, and that the wiretapping, if it's being done for security reasons, isn't being done to them.
Palestinians assume the exact opposite. Saeed Amjad is a 24-year-old construction worker I met at night on the streets of Al Bira, a town in the West Bank.
Palestine, it is the hub of spying. As a Palestinian, you have no protection whatsoever from laws. This phone, anybody could be spying on you and no one would stop it. On your internet, the same.
Another guy working in a cake shop, 23-year-old Abdullah Mohammed, seemed on the verge of tears when he spoke about his fears of being watched.
These days, it's quite natural. I might be walking in the street and somebody behind me is spying on me.
Paranoia about spying is not unfounded. Israel has cultivated a broad network of Palestinian collaborators paid to spy on their communities, sometimes even their families. Asad Ewewe, a political activist and university professor of political science, says he's certain Israeli security has tapped his phone calls. He says an Israeli army official in the West Bank town of Hebron also tried to recruit him. Ewewe says, the military governor of Hebron has called me several times, said, come by for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee to talk. I said, I am not a businessman needy of your help. You are killing my people, and I am not going to sit with you and have a cup of coffee with you. But Israel isn't the only one with ears perked up. Palestinian security services are also known to monitor West Bank Palestinians' communications, chiefly in efforts to round up Hamas and Islamic Jihad activists. Palestinian security officials were trained and funded by none other than U.S. intelligence in Turkey, Jordan, and even in the U.S. So it is understandable and it is expected, Ewewe says, that the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian security agencies, adopt American ways of surveillance on their own people. Palestinians don't know how exactly Palestinian security officials monitor them, but they could get a hint by tuning into the ongoing revelations on domestic surveillance in the U.S., the country that trained their security officials. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Al Bira, the West Bank.
The massive typhoon that hit the Philippines today gathered its power over water, a reminder of the power of the sea. The ocean can bring such tragedy, but it can also bring things we need. Just think about what you're wearing. Chances are something you put on today was made overseas. Even in this jet age, most of the world's trade has moved around the globe by boat. For most of our history, the sea has been a key way to transport people, ideas, even religion to new places. From our history desk, The World That Was, I spoke with Lincoln Payne. He's author of a new book called The Sea and Civilization, A Maritime History of the World. It's a huge canvas, the sea and civilization. Why did you write this and what did you set out to do?
Well, I hoped to integrate a whole variety of different areas of maritime history that people had specialized in over the last 50 or 60 years, but which nobody had ever really approached from a holistic perspective. And I think that one of the interesting things about maritime history is that it seems to be more parochial than a lot of other histories. And you find this particularly at maritime museums, which are all about connections, really focused just on the town or city that they're in.
Let's focus on one aspect that really caught my eye, and that's the way you highlight how the sea has kind of enabled massive cultural transformations. How does that work? I mean, what does the sea do to connect people?
Well, I think that if you think about, say, the era of European expansion in the 15th and 16th centuries, if the Europeans had set out to get to India or China or Southeast Asia by land, it wouldn't have happened. But because they could go by sea, they could penetrate along the coasts of various places. And in fact, that's all they did. For the first 500 years of the European expansion project, really they were pinpricks. As one historian said, they were like lice crawling on the hide of Asia. But it wasn't just the Europeans. Before that, in the Indian Ocean, you had Muslim sailors going to India and to Southeast Asia and to China. And they basically sort of opened these wounds of culture, which then gradually expanded so that you had the conversion of Southeast Asia to first Hinduism and then Buddhism, and then the transmission of a seaborne Buddhism to China.
So your book brings a reader up to the present day. I mean, one thing that I'd have thought would no longer exist is piracy, and yet we do know that it's still there, as bad as it ever was, and maybe even more sophisticated. What's going on with piracy these days? I mean, how do you see the connection between the past and the present? Is it just about poverty and people trying to find opportunity?
For the most part, I think that that is one of the roots. You know, they're sort of depraved on account of their deprived. But, you know, it's also overladen today with sort of networks of international drug traffic and terrorist organizations and things like that. So it is somewhat more complicated. But the roots are very similar. And even more important, the geography is exactly the same, because geography really dictates where piracy takes place, because it's at choke points. Though everybody's sort of funneling all their trade through, say, the mouth of the Red Sea or the Strait of Malacca, it's where a lot of people are also sort of hiding in the bushes and waiting to grab what they can.
What do you think is the biggest issue facing the world today, where the oceans will turn out to be, in your opinion, kind of a crucial player?
Well, the two things that I think are crucial are changing sea level rise, which is going to affect trade throughout the polar regions, of course. But I think it's also going to have a devastating impact on ports. And you look at, you know, sort of proposals for how to save the Port of New York. You really have a mix for a very, very complicated, expensive, and possibly destabilizing set of circumstances. The other issue, of course, is also, and somewhat related to global warming, is also the state of the world fisheries, which are overmanaged and yet mismanaged at the same time, and where, you know, the free hand of the marketplace is really just the last thing you want there.
Oceans cover, what, 7/10 of the world's surface?
Just about, yeah.
I mean, you live in Portland, Maine. Do you ever look out at the ocean, which I'm sure you have many opportunities to do, and just not think about all of this history? You've done some intense research and ended up with a pretty massive book about the sea and civilization. Can you just appreciate the sea these days, or do you think about the whole history behind it?
I think it's always sort of running in the background deeply, but no, I can certainly go to the beach and pick up a book and just lie there and not think about anything else.
Lincoln Payne, the author of The Sea and Civilization, A Maritime History of the World, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure.
A sad note before the break, especially since DJ Shab Isaba brought so much joy to people when he was alive. He died this week after battling stomach cancer for more than 2 years. His legacy? Well, you can feel it on dance floors from Mumbai to Mexico City. He was born into a Jewish Berber family in Algeria with the name Haim Serge Elbaz. He spun American soul 45s in Paris as a teenager, and in the 80s he moved to San Francisco and took on the stage name Shab Isaba, or Young Man of the Morning. His dance tracks brought heavy beats to traditional styles from around the world. He also blurred cultural and political lines. He was a Jewish DJ armed only with a globally minded sound, often at Arab functions. But no one seemed to care. DJ Shab Isaba, gone at the age of 66. Here's a bit more of the joy he left us with. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The immigration debate in Washington has gotten plenty of ink and broadcast time. And in Colorado, time on stage, too. A play about the struggles of undocumented youth just wrapped up a successful run in Denver. The play is based on a book by Helen Thorpe, the separated wife of Colorado's governor. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
The story, Just Like Us, is about four young women from Mexico. They were all brought to Colorado as young children by their parents, illegally. As they grow up, their fortunes start to change. Two of the teens get papers to remain in the U.S. legally. Two don't. The play begins with all four teenagers getting ready for prom. An older Latina woman is doing their hair.
You're going to El College?
Trying. Is that why there's a white lady sitting in the corner taking notes?
Oh, hello. That's Helen.
Helen Thorpe.
Helen is a reporter, a very respected journalist.
She's writing a book about us.
I wanted to give people an opportunity who had no firsthand experience of this to really walk miles and miles in the shoes of these young people.
That's the real-life journalist Helen Thorpe, who wrote the book Just Like Us. She followed the young Mexican women for 5 years.
I found that the debate over immigration law was so incredibly superficial. Generally, people didn't even understand the laws that they were debating. So I wanted to engage readers to capture their attention by how dynamic and vibrant and charismatic these young people were, and then slip a lot of immigration law along. I wanted the reader to care about them as human beings and then understand the immigration predicament that they caught themselves in. And then I wanted the reader to make up his or her own mind about what they think the law should be.
Right. And how did this become a play? I mean, whose idea was it?
Yeah, no, it wasn't my idea. I actually was really surprised when I got an email from Kent Thompson at the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, and he wanted to commission a playwright to write a play based on my book. And he had the idea to get Karen Zacharias involved.
I am a Mexican immigrant myself, and I am a straight-eight student like these girls. And this was a story that I do not see on stage, the story of the good girls, the story of the hardworking families, the story of not the gangs and the barrio and all of that, but the story of millions and millions of people who are in this country just working and trying to get through every day.
In the story, the two undocumented teens can't qualify for scholarships or in-state tuition. They watch as their childhood friends, those with papers, go off to college. But then their luck turns. Benefactors emerge, including a prominent Republican backer, to pay for the women to go to the University of Denver. In college, the women hide their legal status. It's a tense time in Colorado when former Republican Congressman Tom Tancredo leads the call to tighten immigration controls. His speeches on that are in the play. It's also a time when a Denver cop is killed by an undocumented Mexican immigrant. Overall, though, the play is a sympathetic portrayal of the young women, and by extension, undocumented immigrants. Playwright Karen Zacharias says she felt a visceral connection to the women. When I saw it, the 700-seat theater was sold out, and many in the audience, a racially diverse crowd, were crying.
People are moved because theater humanizes an issue. And seeing those four young ladies on stage night after night, you can't help but think, oh, this is not just politics. There's people.
The play has its share of critics, though, and Mexican actress Junwen Pardo knows that. She plays one of the women without papers.
Her name is Maricela, and she's a firecracker.
Maricela is brash and outspoken and dreams of going to law school. But after college graduation, she puts that dream on hold while she raises a child. In the play, the character of Helen Thorpe, the journalist, seems disappointed in Maricela's choices. Pardo describes how this scene played out one night in the theater.
There's a moment where I say, so you think that excelling at school is American and being pregnant is Mexican. And this guy said, well, that's the truth. But he screamed it from the audience. That day I was so fired up because it was just like it was right there.
Of course, Maricela isn't a fictional character. The real Maricela has seen the play 5 times. We met outside the theater, and I asked her how she deals with people like this heckler.
That's a very hard question. Sometimes I feel like those people, it's not even worth spending our time on. I don't think that you can really change people's minds who are that hateful.
I also met the real-life Yadira, the other undocumented woman depicted in the play. Yadira's mom brought her to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 3. She's now 27. I asked her why her family should get a pass to stay in the U.S. when they came here illegally.
Our parents and many parents come into this country to give their children a better life. We came to this country because it was a matter of survival.
In one particularly moving scene, Yadira's mom, a single working mother of 3, is caught using a phony ID. Rather than risk time in a detention center and then likely deportation, Yadira's mom tearfully says goodbye to her family and boards a bus for Mexico.
In the play, it shows her leaving pregnant. So I've never met my little sister. So it would be life-changing for me to be able to meet my little sister and see my mom again.
When was the last time you saw your mom?
Since she left in 2005. Yeah.
Stories like this of family separations and deportations have skyrocketed during President Obama's administration. But Yadira got some good news last week. She qualified for President Obama's program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It basically blocks the deportation of young people like her who are in good standing. But Yadira still lacks certain rights. For example, she can't travel legally to visit her mom in Mexico. The real-life Maricela got tired of living this way. Her husband is a U.S. citizen, but that doesn't give her an automatic right to become one, too. Because she was living here illegally, Maricela first had to leave the country, come clean, then apply to return. There's no guarantees, though. For some couples, the wait to come back can be 10 years or longer.
So we ended up taking the risk, and I did leave. It was almost a year of waiting in Mexico. My husband lost his job. My son went back and forth. It was a very traumatizing experience, but they approved it. And I'm back.
Maricela now does multicultural outreach work at public schools in Denver and has a 2-year provisional visa. I asked her if she's now sleeping better at night.
Oh, yes. It's changed my life in so many ways. But at times, though, I feel like some sort of guilt and privilege because so many of my friends and family members and millions don't have the same opportunity that I have.
The play Just Like Us has finished its 1-month run in Denver. The people invested in it told me they hope another city picks it up. They said it'd be nice if it ran in Washington and that some members of Congress would plan a night out at the theater. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Denver.
I'd see it. I need a stimulating night out. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Carnegie Corporation, by the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.